Okay, so tonight we're going to be surveying the book of Numbers. I don't know if you remember, it's been several years ago, we did abbreviated classes during the semester, just real short, looking at Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So a lot of the material that we're going to be going over tonight is a condensed form of those studies. And so if you have those, I encourage you to look back over them. If you don't, you'll be able to take some of this what we're talking about and use that to further your study of these first five books of the Old Testament. The book of Numbers is one because chapters 1 through 10 tends to be a little bit dry, a little bit complicated, that it's skipped over. It's in the Bible reading programs that we do, that we go through Genesis and it's the beginning of the year and we're all excited, and then we get to Exodus and it's all exciting, and then you get towards the end of Exodus and it starts to taper off a little bit in the excitement category, and it's God detailing the tabernacle, the ark, the altars and all of that. And then you get into Leviticus and sacrifices, and by the time you get to Numbers and counting people, people's eyes tend to glaze over. In doing so, they're missing what is a very fascinating book, as the Pentateuch, the first five books, are very fascinating. But our goal tonight is to see wondrous things out of the law of God as we look at the book of Numbers. Well, when we look at the book of Numbers, you know, we've been starting off talking about the title. Where is it we get the title for Numbers? And notice that in our English Bibles, typically it is a English translation of a Latin word that comes from the Greek word. And so in Greek, the word for Numbers is arithmai. What's that sound like? Arithmetic, counting. And that's what it's about. It's about counting. And then in Latin, it's numeri. And so you're talking numerals, numbers, and that's where we get that. Interesting, okay, so let's test our knowledge here. In the Hebrew, Old Testament, the Hebrew language, typically where did the title of the book come from in the Pentateuch? You remember? It's from the very first verse. And so, you know, if you look back at Leviticus, in Leviticus, it was this, the Lord called, and then Exodus, the very first verse. And so when we look at the Hebrew of the book of Numbers, it's from chapter 1 and verse 1. It says, the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tent of meeting. And really, the title is In the Wilderness Of. That's how the Hebrews designated it. In the Wilderness Of. Well, you think about that, that's kind of an odd way to put it, because we think in terms of numbers and the counting of people. Really, if you look at it from the perspective of numbers, yes, you have that in the first chapter. You have a census, and then back later down in chapter 26, you have a second census, and so it's kind of like bookends of census of the people counting the military strength over this 40-year period of time. But it's also significant of in the wilderness of, because if you start in chapter 1 and verse 1, where are they at? In the wilderness of Sinai. And then as you go through the book, several times in the book it uses the term wilderness, you'll find them in different wilderness. You know, they're in the wilderness of Sinai, then they're in the wilderness of Paran, and then they're in the wilderness of Moab. And the big concept of the wilderness is when they reject God's provision and his protection and going into the land of Canaan, what's he make them do? Wander in the wilderness. And so that really does typify this book. Okay, so when we look at the book, who wrote the book? Moses. About the same time period, 1445 to 1405, somewhere in there. It's obviously it's going to be in the last 40-year block of his life. You remember Moses' life was in three blocks of 40 years. 40 years in the house of Pharaoh, 40 years in the land of Midian as a shepherd, and then 40 years leading the people. And so as he's writing about things that take place while he's leading the people, it's obviously in the last 40 years. The time period, or the period of history, again, is mosaical, and we're going to be repeating that as we go through the rest of the Old Testament. And if you want to talk about years, remember with the book of Numbers, the time period in the book of Numbers, how long was it? One what? 1 month. 1 month. And then when we get to Numbers, what's interesting is we have at the very beginning of the book, from chapter 1 at verse 1, which it says it's the second year, first day, second month, to chapter 10, verse 11, which is the second year, second month, 20th day. Okay, so that's basically a month and a half that you have in those 10 chapters. And then we leave chapter 10, and now we're getting into what will lead up to this 40-year period of time. And so in Deuteronomy chapter 1, it picks up in verse 2 through verse 8. You have the 40th year, 11th month, one day. And they're in the wilderness or in the plains of Moab. So the book of Numbers roughly covers 40 years. Roughly covers 40 years. One-third of the book is just a month when they're at the wilderness of Sinai, and then they're going to leave Sinai. Now, let's get to some of the importance. We've been looking at the Pentateuch from this perspective, how it is it's a nutshell, it's a microcosm of the gospel of Jesus Christ. In the book of Genesis, you have the introduction of sin. Well, in kind of the book of Exodus, what's the S for Exodus? Is salvation, isn't it? In chapter 14, the Israel was by the bank of the Red Sea, and Moses says, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. And then in chapter 14, at the very end of that chapter, it says, God saved Israel that day. And so we have salvation. Then in Leviticus, the key word was sanctification. What's another word for sanctification? Set apart. What else? Holy. Remember, be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. And so it has this perspective of, okay, now that you are saved, you are to live a separate, pure, sanctified, holy life. Now we come to the book of Numbers, and this is how I would categorize it, and that is struggles. As we picture ourselves in this category, we all start off and we are sinners. Romans chapter 3 and verse 23, all sin comes short of the glory of God because we made that choice. Jesus is our path to salvation. It's through the waters. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 uses that illustration. Then we are to be sanctified. 1 Peter chapter 1, we're to be holy because God is holy, and we were purchased with the precious blood of Christ. But as a Christian, is our life easy? No. We're going to face struggles, not just physical struggles, but we're going to face struggles of faith. And that's what happens in the book of Numbers. They face struggles of faith. And so we put up here 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 24 through 27, the Apostle Paul says, do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest what should happen to me? Lest I become disqualified, unless I fall, I fail. In other words, Paul, he acknowledges that as a Christian, even him as an apostle, that he had struggles with faith. And he had to bring his will, his body in control under the will of God, submission to God. He had to do that in order to maintain this path. Now, you come to the book of Numbers, and obviously the big illustration in Numbers of struggling with faith, and what you do is when they look at the land of Canaan and say, we don't want to go in. Yeah, that was their big struggle, and God was going to hold them accountable for that, and definitely Hebrews makes that parallel in chapter 3 and in chapter 4. Now, let's look at some of the information. Let's talk about it historically. Remember, we have our historical, our doctrinal, and our Christological perspective of this. Historically, we look at the book, and this is how it breaks down. It breaks down chapters 1 through 10 is Israel at Mount Sinai. They continue to be there. So Exodus chapter 19, they get to Mount Sinai, they're there, God comes down, or chapter 18, chapter 19, God comes down on the mountain, chapter 19, they haven't left. And so you finish the rest of the book of Exodus, and you get to the very end, and God comes down on the tabernacle, they're still there at Sinai. And then you have 1 month, the book of Numbers, and they're still there, and it's not until chapter 10 where they leave Sinai. So they're still there. And God is wanting them to do some things and to acknowledge some things. And then chapter 10 and verse 11 through chapter 12, they start traveling. They move. And they end up going to Paran. Well, some things happen on the journey from Sinai to Paran. And we'll talk about some of those things that happen. Then they get to Paran. Chapter 13 through chapter 19, and this is where God allows them to send spies into the land of Canaan. And so chapter 13, chapter 14, you're going to have that situation, and then you're going to have some other things that happen there at Paran. Well, because of their unbelief and their rejection, God makes them wander around for 39 to 40 years. And that's what you have here in chapter 20 and 21, is they're moving again. Well, during that period of time, yeah, they're not that faithful. There's some issues that go on there in their journeys. Just a couple. What I find fascinating, 40 years, and God gives it two chapters. He's not dwelling on their unfaithfulness here. And then in chapter 22 through 36, what was the purpose of them traveling for 40 years? Well, say that again? Okay, sin. And because of their sin, God was removing one generation of unfaithfulness, and he's bringing in what he hopes to be a generation of faithfulness. And so they wander. So when you get to chapter 22, now you have this next generation that's come up. And then in chapter 26, you have the second census. It's because it's the second generation. And some things happen while they're in Moab. I can say, give me something you know about Balaam. What do you know about Balaam? Talking donkey. We all know the talking donkey. Okay, that's happening in chapter 22 and following. There's four oracles there. And then God is preparing them to go into the land of Canaan, and he is giving them some final instructions, and then Deuteronomy will come in and finish that. So that's kind of the historical outlook of the book. Here we are camping at the wilderness of Sinai, then we move, and then we're at the wilderness of Paran, and then we move, and then we're at the wilderness or the plains of Moab, and things are happening all along the way. Now let's get to, before we get to your section of this, let's get to the doctrinal aspect. Just simply this, there are laws given and laws clarified. Laws given, laws clarified. There's several laws that are in the book about purification, and some of those things. Okay, and then Christological, which we're using that term just because of the Indian is similar. We're talking messianic things. And this is where the book of Numbers is exciting. The book of Numbers is filled with messianic pictures. And here's some of them. Joe, I messed up again. So click forward. Okay, so it will come up here in a second. The very first one is the rock. Okay, so remember we have a rock that produces water a couple of times. The first time Moses is instructed to strike the rock, it's in the book of Numbers that he is told to speak to the rock, and he strikes it. Well, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4, in that metaphor, it says the rock was Christ. Christ provides for them. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4. In the book of Numbers, in chapter 21, you have this picture of the serpent. People rebel, and the snakes come in, and they bite the people. The people get sick, and remember God's provision for them. So make the bronze serpent, you put it on the staff, and how would you be healed? You had to look at it. In the Gospel of John, chapter 3 and a verse 14, John chapter 3 and a verse 14, this is how Jesus applies this. He says, "And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that whoever believes in him may have eternal life." So he's drawing directly from Numbers chapter 21. Then you're going to have manna. It's a continuation. We've had manna in Leviticus and in Exodus, a continuation manna they would have for 40 years. In John chapter 6, verse 32, Jesus makes a contrast between the manna that God gave them and the fact that they would be hungry the next day. And Jesus is what? He's the bread of life, and you're not going to go hungry again. It's talking about spiritual hunger. Then in Numbers 24, in Balaam's fourth prophecy, the fourth one is all about the Messiah. And in verse 17, you have a prophecy that's about the Messiah. The first three are about Israel. Chapter 24 and verse 17, the fourth one is about the Messiah. And then you have this picture of authority that comes through the book. Not only God's authority, but more importantly, Moses' authority. And you have two situations where Miriam and Aaron, they're not happy with Moses, and they're, you know, equating themselves to Moses. And God is going to judge Miriam. You remember how he judged her? Leprosy. But what God says is, he says, with most prophets, I speak through them. With Moses, in Numbers chapter 12 and at verse 7, with Moses, I speak to him face to face. Now, the reason I draw Matthew 17, what happens in Matthew 17? It's the Mount of Transfiguration. Jesus is on the mountain with Peter, James, and John. And who appears to Jesus? Moses and Elijah. And Peter says, let's build an altar or a tabernacle, something for each one of you. And remember, that it was a cloud that said, this is my beloved son, listen to him. This is the one you listen to. And then in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 5, this is from a quotation from Numbers chapter 12. It says Moses was faithful in all things. He was faithful in all things. And Hebrews says Moses was faithful in all things as a servant. Christ is faithful in all things as a son who's over the house. And so you have an antitype that is there. So there's several pictures there that are just, they're incredibly important to the messianic view of the book. Okay. So now we come to this. So let's start looking at this. In chapter 1, what happens in chapter 1 of Numbers? Okay, it's the counting of who specifically? Men who were of fighting age. Okay, so they're counting the military is what they're doing. And the number you have on the bottom of, or right there in the middle of your sheet, you're talking about 603,550 men who were fighting age and ability at this point. Now, there's one group that's exempted from that, but that was fighting age. Who is that? Levites. Now, why is it the Levites were exempted? They were priests. Okay, they took care of the tabernacle. And remember also, as you'll see in this book, they were the first fruits that represented the people. I mean, these were God's, the ones that stood in place of people. And you see that with from Exodus, where the firstborn passed away when God brought the 10th plague. And because of that, the firstborn belonged to God, but God used the Levites to stand in their place. And it comes up later in the book, if there were more people than Levites, then a certain price had to be paid. And there's a New Testament aspect of this, where it talks about, you know, when the womb is opened, when the cows give birth, and cow, her womb is open, that 8 days later, they were to be dedicated towards God. Now, why is that important when you come over into the Gospels? What's Jesus do when he's, well, let me rephrase that. What's Joseph and Mary do when Jesus is 8 days old? Taken to Jerusalem to be dedicated, and it was based on this firstborn principle, and that's where Joseph and Mary interact with both Anna and Simeon. Okay, so chapter 1, they count the people. Chapter 2, what happens in chapter 2? Okay, it's the arrangement of the camp around the tabernacle, and I want you to look at this. And just kind of see how it happened. I have this chart up here. I didn't produce this. You can see copyright 2011 right there. And it says it's free to reproduce. Okay, so here's your arrangement. What you have in this is the first group, the camp of Judah is what they were called. You have Judah, Issachar, Zebulun. And they were to the east of the tabernacle. Now remember, the tabernacle as well as the temple always pointed east. And if you were in Ezekiel class, that temple pointed east. And remember, the servant comes in from the east and through the east gate. And so you have them right here. And then we move to the south, and you have Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. And then you move to the south, and it's Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. And then to the north, Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, and then in the very middle of them all was the tabernacle. Okay, that's important. But there's another ring, because God always said to Israel, you be very careful around my tabernacle. Don't touch it, don't come near it, things like that. Because if you did, what would happen? Okay, it would be death. And so God placed this protective ring around it. And you have Kohath and his family, 8,600 people. Gershon and his family, 7,500. Merari and his family, 6,200. And then the east side, you have Moses and Aaron's sons. And those sons at this point in time were Eleazar and Ithamar that would sit there on the east side. Does anything strike you about this picture? Who is allowed to go into the tabernacle? Priests were able to go into the tabernacle, specifically this front portion right there. Well, let me get this. front portion right there. The priests were able to go on. They would do the altar of incense that was inside there. They would burn incense on it continually. The high priest goes in one day a year, day of what? Atonement, Leviticus chapter 16. He goes in on that one day a couple times, and he does that. No one else is able to go into that area, and that's where the Ark of the Covenant was. So God always had this separation, didn't he? Only one person can come into my presence within the tabernacle. And so only a few people were able to do that, okay? So you have Aaron and his role. And then you have all around the tabernacle Levites. And so as Aaron was the only one that could go before God on the Day of Atonement, you also had this separation, the Levites. The people always had to act through Levites. They were the barrier, if you were, between the people and the tabernacle, physically and then also in regards to worship. So the people were always separated from what was holy. So the tabernacle is holy. It's in the midst of them. The people aren't able to approach and to interact and things like that. And there's always that separation until what? There's a point where that separation comes to an end. Okay, you have the crucifixion. What happens to the veil? The veil of the temple tears top to bottom. God removes the barrier. So the high priest at that point is able to go in. And that high priest, of course, is Christ, who goes in behind the veil, the Hebrew writer says. And there he mediates on our behalf. But the other aspect of it is now, if someone was to walk in front of the temple with that veil there and the doors were open, they could see all the way in, couldn't they? And they could see into the most holy place. They can have access now. Well, also in the New Testament, we as Christians, we have access to God through our mediator, our high priest. We have access. And then additionally, we're not camped around the outside anymore, because who are we? We're priests. We're priests. And so there's this great picture here of God's holiness and then his priesthood and then the people. And then with Christ, he's able to bring us into his service. We're called his priests. And we have confidence to go before the throne of God, Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 12, and just before that, we have confidence because of those things. Now, one other lesson from this is, in the camp, where was the tabernacle? Okay, who's the center of their lives? Always God. God's always the center of their lives. And God's always to be the center of our lives. And so when we talk about the arrangement of the camp in chapter 2, I'd suggest it's not just something to yawn at. There is a purpose and a design behind what God did. Now, secondly, when the camp moved, where would the tabernacle and those that carried the tabernacle elements, where would they walk? If I remember right, it was in the middle, wasn't it? You would have those that carry the tabernacle, the things that happen in the middle. So you have God still at the center. He's still at the center of that. Okay, now let's move on. Chapter 3 and chapter 4, you have duties of the Levites. Okay, you have duties of the Levites. Chapter 5, God desires a clean people. And so he talks about physical defilement, verse 1 through verse 4. If you know someone has a discharge or someone is leprous, put them outside the camp, okay? And then verse 5 through verse 10 is about restitution. So if you break faith with someone, then there has to be restitution, and so there is cleanliness in a sense. Then verse 11 through 31, I think, is one of the most interesting chapters in the Bible, and that's there's a test for adultery. And if you suspected your wife of adultery, then there was a process before the priest in which it could be determined if she was adulterous. By the way, if you accused your wife of adultery and you went before the priest and you went through this process and she wasn't adulterous, how do you think your life would go? So what do you need to make sure before you go to the priest? You make sure that this is something you're serious about, that this actually took place. Otherwise, you don't want to go down that path. And then in chapter 6, what's chapter 6? It's about cleanliness. Okay, it's Nazarite vows, separated. And the Nazarites, give me some of the things that they were not allowed to do. Okay, not allowed to cut their hair until the end of their vow. Okay, they weren't to drink any alcohol, not even to touch a grape. They were to stay away from it. And the thing with the Nazarite vow, it was for a period of time. It was a self-designated period of time. It was, okay, I'm going to do this for X number of days or X number of months or however long. There are some that took Nazarite vows for a lifetime. Samson is one of those, that he was placed under for his entire life. But typically it was for a short period of time. And then at the end of chapter 6, this is when God's people are clean, then God blesses his people. And we know this because we sing this in our hymns. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And so when God's people are what they ought to be, then you have peace and you have graciousness and you have the Lord's blessing and his protection and keeping that's there. Chapter 7 is offerings, consecration at the tabernacle. So when the tabernacle was consecrated, the heads of families, the heads of the tribe would bring in a certain gift at that point for that. We come to chapter 8. The Levites are consecrated, and you have that there. And then chapter 8, verse 23. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, this applies to the Levites from 25 years old and upward. They shall come do duty in the service of the tent of meeting. And from the age of 50 years, they shall withdraw from duty of the service and serve no more. They minister to the brothers in the tent of meeting by keeping guard, but they shall do no service. Thus shall you do to the Levites in assigning their duties. In essence, what's he tell the Levites? You serve for how long? 25 years. And then you, in essence, retire. In essence, retire. You weren't allowed to serve. You could guard, but you weren't allowed to do the sacrifices and things like that. God took care of them and provided a retirement for them, and he provided a retirement income for them as well, because they were able to gain financially, and they were able to gain through sacrifices and be taken care of their lives. And so that's at the end of chapter 8. Chapter 9, important. Mark this down. It's the second Passover. When's the first Passover? Exodus chapter 12, you have the first Passover. This is the second Passover. Why this is important? This will be the last Passover for 40 years. They had two, and they messed up. And they would not have another Passover until Joshua chapter 1, when they go into the land of Canaan. That says something about them. Any comments through chapter 9, chapter 10? Chapter 10, verse 11, they leave Sinai. Chapter 11, Tell me about chapter 11. Do you guys do like I do and read the headings of the chapter? People complain. You have a lot of complaining. Goes on in chapter 11. Look at chapter 11 and verse 1. What were the people complaining about? They're not to food yet. Now they're talking about their misfortune. Our lives are horrible. And so they complain. And what's God do? He sends fire, burns them, consumes them until Moses intercedes for them. Verse 4, the rabble that was among them had strong craving, and the people of Israel wept again and said, "Oh, that we had meat to eat. Oh, we want meat." And so you get down to verse 31 of that chapter. What's God do? Sends them quail. He sends them quail. So you have people complaining because of misfortune. You have people complaining because of meat, not having any meat. Who's the one person you think wouldn't complain? Who sees God deal with his people in a harsh manner when they complain? Who would be the one person who said, "I'm not going to complain"? Moses. Guess what Moses does? He complains. Verse 10, Moses heard the people weeping through their clans, everyone at the door, and the anger of the Lord blazed hotly, and Moses was displeased. And Moses says, "Why have you dealt ill with your servant? God, why'd you put me in this place? These people are horrible. My life is horrible." So Moses complains about this to God. And so what's God do? Look at verse 16. Lord said to Moses, "Gather for me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and officers over them, and bring them to the tent of meeting." God says, "Okay, Moses, you're upset. You feel like you have a lot that's placed on you. Let me give you some elders to help you in this process." And so when people are complaining about their misfortune, God judges them, and then he relents. When they complain about meat, he sends them quail. When Moses complains about being alone and this hard work that he's doing, God says, "Okay, I'm going to give you people." In other words, when we complain, what's God do? He's going to do one of two things. To make it worse, tell you not to complain, or number two, he's going to provide a way out. And he provides that way out. So I like chapter 11 there for that. Chapter 12, this is Miriam and Aaron, and they're complaining, right? They're complaining. God deals with them. I like here in verse 2, they say, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not also spoken through us?" And then in verse 7, "Not so of my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. With him I speak mouth to mouth, clearly and not in riddles, and he beholds the form of the Lord." What a position Moses is in. God speaks to him face to face, and he says, "He sees my form." Now, he saw the form when God put him in the cleft of the rock and passed by him. He saw the backside, but God says, "He sees me." There's different relationship that is there. Chapter 13, chapter 14, big chapters. Chapter 13 is the spies. What was their excuse for not going into the land? They looked at the people, and they said they're giants. But notice, look in verse 33. "And there we saw the Nephilim, and there we saw the sons of Anak who come from the Nephilim. And we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." What's odd about their statement? They forgot God. What's their perspective? From whose vantage point do they feel like they're grasshoppers? Themselves. And they said, and we seem like this to them. Do you think they went up to the sons of Enoch and said, hey, what do you think about us? No. They assume because we feel like this, then the sons of Enoch are looking at us like this. Their perception was skewed. They didn't trust God, and for this reason, they weren't going to be allowed to enter the land of Canaan, all except for who? Joshua and Caleb. In chapter 14, the people rebel. This is a continuation of that story. They're going to rebel, and God is going to make them wander. Then we have chapters 15, chapter 17, and you have here what is a contrast to chapter 13 and 14. Man's rebellion, chapter 13 and verse 14, chapter 15, and then chapter 17, God's blessing when people approach him the right way. They follow him. They respect his authority. In chapter 15, at the end of that, in verse 32, there's a man who's out picking up sticks on the Sabbath day. And what happens to him? He's stoned. He didn't respect the authority of God. Then in verse 37, they were to put tassels on their garments. And when you look at the tassels, verse 39, you remember all the Lord's commandments to do them, not to follow after your own heart, your own eyes, because everyone had been rebelling up to this point. So God's saying, put these tassels on your garment. You look at the tassels, you remember, oh, follow God. Oh, follow God. Keep following God. Now, what happens in Jesus' day to those tassels and those types of things? They enlarged the borders of their garments. They enlarged these things. They took stock in those things as being signs of faithfulness. When those weren't signs of faithfulness, those were signs to help them to remember to be faithfulness. It wasn't about being faithful because you had tassels on your garments. Those tassels told you to be faithful to God, and they got those things mixed up. All right, chapter 16, Korah's rebellion. Who's Korah rebel against? He rebels against Moses and Aaron. What happens to Korah and his family? Earth swallows them up. You would think murmuring, complaining, rebelling, that you would learn your lesson eventually, but they didn't. Then in chapter 17, you have Aaron's rod bud. God placed his stamp of approval on Aaron. What happened to that rod? It was to be in the Ark of the Covenant. It was a testimony that of God's relationship with the high priest. You go to chapter 20, and you have Moses striking the rock. I wonder if you had one thing you could take back. I think Moses, this would be his one thing. Why did Moses lose control? He is angry and frustrated. He lost patience. He took his eyes off to God. You know, when we get frustrated, it's easy to get angry. But you know what frustration is? Frustration is when people or things do not meet our expectations of what they should meet. Parents get frustrated with kids because parents have ideals in their mind of what kids ought to be. And when those kids don't reach those ideals, you get frustrated and provoked. And there's room for discipline, but that's where frustration comes from. Moses gets frustrated with the people because he forgets it's about God and he looks at himself. And so he gets frustrated with people. My clock says 8 minutes. Do I have 8 minutes? 1 minute? That's first bell. Okay. Okay, and let's just go real quick here. I apologize for the time. Chapter 21, the bronze serpent. People rebel again. They murmur. The serpent, you know that story. Chapter 22 through 24 is Balaam. Interesting question. for you to think about. Balak, king of Moab, sends people to bring Balaam because Balak wants Balaam to curse Israel. When those men get there, the first thing God says is, don't go with them. Okay, so that's number one, don't go with them. If you read on further, second group comes, and God tells Balaam, okay, go with them. And so Balaam gets on his donkey and he rides, and God gets angry with him because he's going, and that's where the angel stands in the way of the donkey, and Balaam gets angry with the donkey because he's frustrated because the donkey didn't meet his expectation. And God gets angry, okay? But God said, go ahead and go with him, Balaam. And then God gets angry. I want you to think about and reason and try to figure out why it is that God gets angry. I think there's a reason why God gets angry. But eventually, God allows him to go. And whenever Balak wants Balaam to speak ill of Israel, what does Balaam do? He speaks positive, blessing on Israel. And there's four oracles, four prophecies. The first three are about Israel. And in it, it's Israel's God's chosen. That's number one. God conquers through Israel, and then God's going to bless Israel. And then the last one is about Christ. So you can look at those. Then we get to, there's a problem with Balaam in chapter 25. But then if we want to jump ahead, chapter 35, God makes provision. God makes provision. What's God's provision? He gives them six, what? Cities of refuge. And he promises more than six if they need them, if they take the land. But they never do. So there's only six. Three on the east, three on the west side of the Jordan. And this is where if you killed someone, you could run and your life would be spared if it was determined it was manslaughter. If it was not manslaughter, then you would be killed. Bottom line of this book, we struggle. We have times of unfaithfulness, shallow faith, weak faith. But in the end, what does God do? God still provides. He is patient, he's loving, he's merciful, and he continues to provide and will provide for us if we seek refuge. Okay, next week we're going to be looking at Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy. Any comments, questions, thoughts? Chapter 1, verse 1, I think, is the idea of wilderness. So you go, chapter 1, you can see wilderness. I think it's something like 40 times in the book the word wilderness is used. Man's in wilderness, God provides. And then the messianic comparisons, those are big keys. One last thing, if I could do this real quick. We talk about Israel counting God's people. Israel is counted but cannot be counted on. Kind of think about that as you go on. Can't be counted on. Okay, thank you. Next week, Deuteronomy.